Welcome to this, the inaugural episode of Podcasters Royale. I'm your host, Hayden Gribble, and today I'm joined by two very special guests, podcasters and Bond fan supreme, Mr. Rob Irwin and Mr. Steve Hayward. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello there.
Hi.
And I suppose the first thing that we should talk about today is the news that, well, the news from a variety of sources that Daniel Craig won't be returning as 007. He's reportedly turned down a £68 million deal for two more films. That's $100 million. What do you make of this news?
Well, it's even more in Australian dollars.
Everything's always more in Australian dollars.
And yeah, look, he seemed very unhappy during the Spectre press tour. It seemed that he was making rumbles back then about not liking being in the Bond franchise. I thought, oh, well, maybe he's negotiating his next contract. Maybe that's his strategy. But it doesn't seem to be that way. He seems to be genuinely unhappy, displeased, doesn't want to go back to Bond, and it doesn't matter how much money you throw at him, he's just not interested. It also probably doesn't help that I think Tom Hiddleston's been seen with the producers in a meeting this past week.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that normally gives it away. That normally gives it away that something big's happening, doesn't it? The recasting, when you've got a big actor sort of going out and being wined and dyed by the producers. I think you've got a point there, Rob. Steve, what do you think?
Well, we know each other originally through Doctor Who podcasting, don't we? And there was a big thing when Christopher Eccleston left Doctor Who that certain fans couldn't imagine. How could anyone not want to spend the rest of their life acting in Doctor Who? And it must seem to us the most amazing fun, say, to be James Bond. But I could imagine how it could easily, the excitement about it could easily pall for an actor. And of course, we don't know. He behind the scenes, he might be getting, big offers from other franchises to appear in them, which he can't commit to. It may just be he's, I don't think we should assume he's fallen out of love with it. It's just that it's probably unusual to continue, say, as long as Roger Moore did, rather than assuming, say, oh, well, that must be the basic rule of thumb, that you stay for. How long did Roger Moore stay for?
Well, Roger Moore stayed for 12 years, but in that time he made 7 films.
Oh,
now,
that's true, yes.
I think this is one of the frustrations for Daniel Craig, is that he's made 4 in the last 11 since he was announced in 2005, and his productions have been fraught with, MGM very nearly went under due to bankruptcy. Quantum of Solace was made during the writer's strike, which led to Daniel Craig even having to add dialogue himself to the script. So I think it's possibly those frustrations might be influencing his decisions. Who do you think would make a great replacement? I mean, like Rob said, Tom Hiddleston's been hinted at in the press. What do you think? Steve?
I can't think, really. They're always coming up with Idris Elba's name, aren't they? Although what's unfortunate is that a lot of the people who come up with his name seem to... You would thought the proper thing to do was say, oh, I think it would be brilliant as an actor for Bond. But a lot of them seem to continue by saying, I think it'd be great to have a black actor for Bond, which, as great as it would be, you think of slightly more tactful and less patronising ways of expressing that. But I think he's probably too old. And also, I think he's too built physically, whereas perhaps Tom Hiddleston's too skinny. Because Tom Hiddleston could always bulk up in the gym. Whereas he's not, Bond, he's not a superhero in the Marvel sense, where he's muscle-bound like Thor. He's sort of, a spy who's also a dapper boulevardier in the casino.
Rob, what do you think?
Yeah, look, I think Tom Hiddleston might have it. You know, I think the bookies have even stopped taking bets on it, which is always a fair sign. But in terms of other young British actors, I mean, someone like a Tom Hardy could probably turn his hand to it quite well. Idris Elba does get mentioned a lot, but as I've said to people on Facebook before, I think by the time he would get around to making one, he'd be the age where Daniel Craig had already made two by that age. You know, he's just a little bit too old. And yeah, he is pretty big. I guess a secret agent does need to be more of an everyman sort of shape to perhaps fit in. You know, maybe that if you stand out too much as a secret agent, it's not a good look. So yeah, to that, I think maybe it's Hiddleston.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right as well. And I think you're right in saying, you know, if it's really you need an actor to play Bond in sort of in their mid to late 30s, I think. Because if they're going to stick around for as long as Craig has, or indeed for as long as Roger Moore did, you don't really want to see a sort of, you know, View to a Kill Roger Moore in his late 50s walking around. Because it just becomes implausible, really, doesn't it? Even, you know, even in this day and age. I think you need someone who needs, you know, who needs to mature in the role. So I think maybe someone like Hiddleston with his age, I think he's 37, isn't he, Hiddleston? So with regards to that, he's actually sort of fits in my bracket. It'll be interesting to see how the story unfolds, I think, really, because we still haven't got any official word that Craig has even said these things. You know, maybe he will come back and do another film or two, but I don't know. We shall have to see. We shall have to see.
He might always be. You know, it's part of negotiation for a bigger payday.
Well, exactly.
You know, if you're suggesting that, if you go out and say, yes, I never want to leave doing Bond films, then we'd have to pay him that much then. Whereas if you say, oh, well, I don't want to do it, oh, sure, we've got to up the ante to make him stay.
Yes.
I don't know. It wasn't one of the quotes from around the time of Spectre that he'd rather eat his own testicles than come back or something. It was something quite dramatic along those lines. And I think he even said then, if I did come back, it would just be for the money. So he seemed to be right off the idea even back then.
It's a shame. I mean, what have you made of his Bond?
I really liked it. The Casino Royale I thought was fantastic. Quantum of Solace I seem to enjoy more than other folk. Skyfall was fantastic. And then the most recent film was a bit of a letdown, Spectre. But on the whole, I've quite liked it. Probably the most disappointing aspect of his Bond has perhaps been his off-screen attitude towards the franchise.
I thought he was amazing in Casino Royale. I probably less remember how he was in Quantum of Solace, because I only ever watched it once. I thought it was such a terrible film. Skyfall he was good in, but they did this thing where, oh, let's spend half the film making him aged and decrepit. And I thought, well, I don't want that. I don't want in my Bond films agonising about existential problems that the character has. I want him being Bond. Spectre, he was a lot better in. But he's always, my problem with, I suppose it's Sean Bean.
we'll come to that.
we'll get to him.
Daniel Craig has always been that he's far too much the thug. And he's not. But Bond isn't a thug. He can be thuggish. But he's, the whole point of Bond is that he's the guy who's 1 minute leaping from girder to girder in a hollowed out volcano base, and the next minute he's strolling suavely into a casino in a black tie. And if you could say, oh yes, we want to make it more just the one side of him, you say, well, I'll go and watch Jason Bourne films if I want to see that.
Yeah, it's very true. 007 films do need their own identity, don't they? But right, let's get on to the main topic of the day, and that is GoldenEye.
When the world is the target.
72 hours ago, a secret weapon system was detonated over Severnaya.
And the threat is real.
GoldenEye exists. A radiation surge that destroys everything with an electronic circuit.
You can still depend on one man.
I want you to find GoldenEye.
Three.
Find who took it.
Two.
And stop it.
One.
I
Name's Bond. James Bond.
The world's most famous secret agent is back.
We aim to please.
And this time, 007 is facing the ultimate enemy. The man who knows him best.
Hello, James.
What an unpleasant surprise.
006.
What's the message? No pithy comeback?
He was your friend, and now he's your enemy, and you will kill him.
Is the satellite in range? Target is London.
Now, the entire world is about to be caught in the crossfire.
See you in hell, James.
You first.
Kill him.
The pleasure will be all mine.
Did you check her out?
Head to toe.
Three clicks, arms the fuse. Don't say it.
The writing's on the wall.
Grow up, 007.
I think you're a sexist, misogynist dinosaur, a relic of the Cold War.
You know, James, I was always better.
Both of you, stop it. You're like boys with toys.
Trick is to quit while you're still ahead.
I wouldn't think of it.
Charming, sophisticated secret agent. Shaken, but not disturbed.
Get us out of here!
Bond. Only Bond. The man just won't take a hint.
He don't need the gun.
That depends on your definition of safe sex.
On November 17th...
Grab him!
United Artists brings you...
Trust me.
James Bond.
Why can't you just be a good boy and die?
Now that's one trick I've never learned.
So, GoldenEye was released in November 1995, directed by Martin Campbell. And it starred in his very first appearance as James Bond 007, Pierce Brosnan. So, when did you first see GoldenEye? Was it at the cinema for both of you? Or
for me, it was at the cinema, definitely. And it was also the first Bond film I ever saw at a cinema as well.
Oh, wow. Okay. Quite a Bond film to see for the first time as well at the cinema.
Absolutely.
Steve, I suppose it would probably be the same story for you then.
It was, well, not the first. It might have been the umpteenth I'd seen at the cinema for the first time. But I don't remember seeing it. I just assume I must have done, because it's unlikely I would have missed it. When did it come out?
1995, yeah.
Yeah. But I can't remember seeing it at the cinema, but I assume I must have done.
Yeah, and of course this was the return for 007, sort of almost a reboot, as it were, 6 years after License to Kill. Now, the reason for that six-year sort of hiatus, I suppose you could call it, is because Cubby Broccoli's company and MGM got in a legal dispute, which actually led to Timothy Dalton sort of retiring the role early and leaving his three-film contract, which he apparently, according to Dalton, was ready to go in 1990. It's going to be called The Property of a Lady, which is, of course, is an Ian Fleming title. It's going to be set somewhere in Hong Kong, and they never got around to making it. And then, of course, GoldenEye comes up, and Brosnan, who originally was supposed to be James Bond from The Living Daylights onwards, but unfortunately Remington Steele, the program that he was on in America, tied him up with another contract at, cool, people say about the 11th hour, but I think this is more the 12th hour they made that decision. So so this was Pierce Brosnan's debut as 007, and what were your thoughts on the film in general?
I was very excited by it because there always had been that buzz around Pierce Brosnan becoming Bond, and finally he was Bond. So I thought he made a great Bond. I was so excited to sit there and see that opening sequence, him bungee jumping, as it were, off that dam in Soviet Russia. Just so excited to be seeing it, and seeing my first Bond film at the cinema as well, as I mentioned. Just fantastic.
If you could add so much to compare it to, it was, well, I was excited to see it, but on reflection, it's less of a great Bond movie for me. Pierce Brosnan, he's far more Bond-like visually than Timothy Dalton was. Timothy Dalton, I always thought, it's probably something to do with, not so much to do with him, but to do with the fact that it was, his stuff was done during the 80s. was far more Bergerac than Bond.
Ooh, okay.
And by that, I don't mean that there's anything wrong with Bergerac, but it's something that when I think of Bergerac, I think, oh yes, 1980s, particular type of way of dressing, and it's probably the fact that it reminds me of the 80s, rather than the fact that there's anything wrong with that. And it just makes, oh yeah, he's more Bond. So they tried with Dalton, didn't they, to, well, let's stop him sleeping around and, you know, being chauvinistic. Then, well, you might as well stop him being James Bond if he's going to do that. Yeah, so an improvement on Timothy Dalton, I'd say.
Interesting. And of course, with this being sort of a reboot of such, I mean, the first thing that really stuck out for me when I watched it again the other day was the gun barrel sequence, which I actually think is the best gun barrel sequence of the lot. You've got this beautiful sweeping CGI, it's glistening and shimmering. And then Brosnan comes in, you know, really strong, very confident, obviously shoots down the barrel, the blood comes down. It looked sleek. And then, of course, we open up into that brilliant bungee jumping sequence. It's quite a spectacular start for a new Bond film, isn't it, Steve?
Yes, I think the only thing qualm I've got with the gun barrel sequence, I thought the music over it was a bit tinny. When he walks across the gun barrel and it's going dum 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 dum, it sounded quite tinny. Who was it did the music for this?
It was the composer Eric Serra who did this one.
Serra, yeah. I mean, none of the music that I remember from GoldenEye was particularly, you know, memorable. And I thought, well, the thing about the gun barrel sequence is it immediately tells you it's Bond, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like that Star Wars opening fanfare. It reassures you, oh, you're right back into what the franchise is about, if I can use that awful word.
Oh, you had to use the F word on a on the podcast straight out the bat there, Steve. First episode, and we've already had the F word on it. Rob, what?
The F bomb.
Rob, what did you make of the new look, as it were?
I could see that it was a new look because I'd obviously seen the earlier Bond films on home video and television many, many times. But in some ways, and this is particularly now in hindsight, even watching it just the other day, it still feels like an older Bond film to me. It is a reboot of sorts. But, you know, musical cues in particular, some of the comedy elements, it's certainly more in line with what I would say older Bond is, like, say, 80s Roger Moore Bond, than it is like Daniel Craig Bond. It definitely leans towards the past, not the future. Although at the time, it probably did feel quite fresh.
When it comes to reboots, Casino Royale is undoubtedly a reboot. It changes everything. You don't have Q, you don't have the gadgets, you don't have Moneypenny, you know, and you barely have a gun barrel sequence at the start. So all of these, like the makeup of James Bond, they pull apart for that film. For this film, they keep them all in place, I suppose, because they wanted it to feel familiar. So although they wanted to bring it up to date, they wanted the films to feel familiar as well.
Didn't they even cut out the da-da-da-da-da-da stuff out of Casino Royale deliberately?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they do.
See, I don't know why they do that sort of thing. I mean, why would you want to... You're almost saying, yes, I'd love to make another Bond film, but we must take away as much of what makes it iconically Bond as we can. As if you're ashamed of the past. Well, if you want to do that, go and make Jason Bourne films.
Right, let's talk about the casting. So, for this film, of course, we've got Brosnan in his first ever appearance as James Bond. We've also got Sean Bean as Alec Trevelyan, or 006, as it were. I mean, that was quite a... It's quite interesting to think that they you know, this is the 17th Bond film, and they hadn't done that before, put Bond up against someone who is his equal and opposite in almost every way. What did you think of the casting of Sean Bean, Rob?
Oh, look, very excited. I'm a Sean Bean fan. I love Sean Bean in Sharp. I love Sean Bean in all the films he's been in. And I think he plays this, as you say, he's a nice counterpoint to Bond because he does have all the skills of a 00 agent. But visually, he is blonde. Bond is dark. You know, they're almost yin and yang. They're opposites to each other as well. It's beautiful. I love the fact he's up against a double agent. It's the most deadly kind of foe he could be up against.
Oh, absolutely. And it's somebody who knows him inside out as well, isn't it? I mean, there's a great line when they're actually in the GoldenEye satellite where he says, "I might as well ask if all the vodka martinis ever silenced the screams of the men you've killed, or if you find forgiveness in the arms of all those willing women for all the dead ones you failed to protect." I mean, that's incredible, because that's really getting underneath the skin of a character who, let's not forget, earlier on in the films, lost his wife.
Mm, that's right.
You know, I think that that's a brilliant piece, and that there's some excellent sort of character evaluations of 007 as this film goes along. But I think that that's one of the ones that really sort of cuts, really goes through the nerve, doesn't it, with him?
It's an interesting way of doing it, isn't it, in that we've never seen him with another...
Yeah. Exactly, because I think the only ever time you see a 00 agent in the field is 008 when he's dressed as a clown in Octopussy. So I think that's the only thing we've got to go on. Sometimes it feels like 007 really is the only agent working for the British Secret Service.
As far as Sean Bean's concerned, I don't think it quite works, because I can't get past the accent on it. Same way as I think he's, accent-wise, he's... who played Obi-Wan Kenobi in the Star Wars prequels? It's Ewan McGregor playing Obi-Wan Kenobi. And it sounds like someone trying to do that accent. Right, and therefore, he's struggling to... It acts as a barrier between his acting and the camera, I think. I'm not sure if people outside the UK will necessarily notice this much, but it sounds like someone really artificially putting on that sort of accent. Now, they could have played it, I suppose, that he's supposed to be turned from Cossacks, isn't he? There's no suggestion that that's why he doesn't sound at home in that accent as Pierce Brosnan does. Especially when you consider Pierce Brosnan's Irish. But I've moaned for a long time. I'm not one of these people who subscribes to this current fetish to say, oh yes, we must get rid of this tradition of having actors speaking with received pronunciation, and we must get back to British regional accents. I loathe that. I mean, yeah, it may be more real, but you can't. If you have someone saying something like "Good evening, Mr. Bond," he's either got to have a heavy German accent, which would make him sound menacing, or he's got to sound silky smooth, posh. It doesn't work if it's set in a Yorkshire accent. It says, "Good evening, Mr. Bond." "Hey, up there, lad." I don't think it works. Great actor, but I suppose they feel that if they put him as a 00 agent speaking with a Yorkshire accent, they're probably thinking, oh, this no one's going to fall for this. And it's possibly because I think what's happened was when they used to do at places like RADA is they'd take people, break down their actual accents that they grew up with, and turn them into essentially a cannon fodder for the Royal Shakespeare Company with their accent. And if it's broken down like that, so to the point where you're speaking with what's called received pronunciation, you're constantly speaking what is in itself an artificial accent, it's then maybe easier to go into what we might term posh English, or into a foreign accent, or into an Irish accent, or an American accent, than it is if you're... Because Sean Bean, everything he's been in, seemingly, it seems to be his native accent. And maybe if he's suddenly trying to move away from that to something else, it doesn't come across for me, unfortunately. But as an actor, amazing.
But what about as a threat in this film, as the main villain? How does he rank for you two? Because he's quite realistic, isn't he? At the same time, I mean, he hasn't got, you know, grand designs of ending the world and submerging it under the ocean or anything like that. All he's really interested in is, you know, sort of bringing it economically to its knees and sort of using GoldenEye to destroy London just to cover it up, really.
Yeah, I think it's a very believable sort of thing, you know, believable in the sense of other Bond films are maybe less believable. it's a good kind of plot. And I mean, it's not a plot from a Ian Fleming novel. We should make that clear. I think it's the first Bond film that wasn't. But it's believable. It's up to date. It still feels fairly contemporary today. It kind of has a cyber espionage kind of feel to it. And that holds up. Some of the older Bond plots don't these days.
Indeed. And, of course, let's move on now to the Bond girls for this film. So the main Bond girl is played by Isabella Skorupko, and it was played Natalia Simonova. Oh, sorry, Natalia Simonova. And then, of course, we had Famke Janssen, who, of course, has gone on to appear in the X-Men films as Jean Grey, as Xenia Onatopp. Now, chaps, if there's ever a name that was ever written to encourage Mike Myers and Austin Powers, I think it's this one, don't you?
Simeonova. Yes, she's very much... When you first see her in that car chase, where she's all vamping out of this red sports car she's in, I thought, oh, it's going to be... This is just some throwaway female character that they never see again. I was quite surprised to remember that she actually becomes Xenia. It's just unusual. Have we ever had... Oh, of course, we've had Fräulein Bunt, haven't we? Have we had a female henchman before for the main villain?
Oh, you've had quite a few.
Oh, of course, we're talking about... As soon as I said that, I think they're all coming back to me. It's Rosa Klebb.
Yep.
But actually, if you think about it, that's interesting, isn't it? Because Rosa Klebb, Fräulein Bunt, they're both, shall we say, very unfeminized women characters, aren't they?
Matronly.
And, of course, this one is incredibly feminized. I mean, you've got this sort of this sadist, you know, sort of lust murderer who crushes her victims between her thighs. And you think, you know, I mean, there are some tropes. This is one of the hangovers, I think, that Rob was talking about regarding sort of the older Bonds. I mean, you could imagine Roger Moore coming against, I mean, even Sean Connery coming up against somebody like this. I mean, it's one of those sort of those... It's one of those traits. It's a bit like Jaws' teeth.
Mm.
You know, it's something which is supposed to, you know, make them unique and make them different. And I mean, I think she's incredible. I mean, actually, at some points, I don't know whether you'd agree, Rob, but at some point, she even eclipses the main Bond girl.
Oh, look, I think so. Natalia is a lovely girl. She wears a nice short haircut, probably only second to Natalie Imbruglia. But,
yes.
But she does spend a lot of the film just running away from explosions. Xenia, like a lot of villains, has a bit more to play with and can vamp it up a bit more and you know, really, really go to town. And she is a delight, you know, from the moment we see her in that sports car, like Steve was talking about, right through to the way she gets dispatched at the end, which I'm sure we'll get to. She is great. Natalia flies a bit more under the radar, but she has her moments as well.
Indeed. And then, of course, we've got a new M in the form of Judi Dench, or Dame Judi Dench, as she is now. I mean, what did you make of that casting decision? Because obviously there's such a big clear out from License to Kill. This is one of the things that makes me think it's, you know, they really did go for a reboot with this one, because obviously Bond's changed, Moneypenny's changed. And, of course, Judi Dench is now playing M, and Robert Brown's out. I mean, it was. Do you think it was quite brave at the time, or do you think it was the right time?
Well, I've just thought, actually, she's not the first female henchman to not to be defeminized. I'm thinking, I'm forgetting Mayday, Grace Jones, of course. But I think... I like the way they've done it, but I don't think... I think for this first film, I don't think Judi Dench comes across very well as M, because she's very cold and clipped, whereas if you go on to something like... I don't know, maybe this is an intentional progression, that she starts off as... what do they call her? The evil queen of numbers or something.
Yeah.
And she would, you know, after some number of years, she would mellow and become warmer. But in Casino Royale... Later on, 2006, she's a much warmer character. When Bond breaks into her apartment, she's both saying, break into my apartment again and I'll kill you, or whatever she say. But she's also quite vulnerable, which is quite nice. I don't like. I think the problem with her line, "You're a sexist misogynist, but a dinosaur bomb," is that it dates the film awfully. It's clearly meant to be, oh, let's give her a line which is a nod against the historical chauvinism of the franchise, and it just comes across as very, very, okay, that's very, very 1990s, isn't it?
Yeah, and then she also says that he's a relic of the Cold War as well, doesn't she? And his boyish charms are lost on her. I mean, like I said, Bond is dressed down quite a lot in this film, and I'm not just talking about the sauna scene. I mean, Rob, what did you make of? So we got new money penny in the form of Samantha Bond, and even she sort of stands up to Bond in a way that you've never seen Money Penny do before. There's, you know, she's in the office, it's late at night, and she's been out on a date, and Bond's complimented her on her look, and she says, "I know you'll find this crushing, 007, but I don't sit at home every night praying for some international incident so I can run down here all dressed up to impress James Bond." And he also goes on to say, "As far as I can remember, James, you've never had me." And he says, "Hope springs eternal." And then, of course, she retorts, and this is the first time in 30 years of Bond film, or 32 years at that point. She says, "You know, this sort of behaviour could qualify as sexual harassment." And you think, finally, you know, someone said what the audience has been thinking all that time. And, you know, she says, "Someday you will make good on your innuendos." And I think, you know, it's good to sort of show that time is moving on, and it doesn't demean Bond in any way as well. It just means that, I don't know, I suppose people are, you know, the people around him, his team around him are, I don't know, sort of catching up with him, I guess, I suppose.
Yeah, it's an acknowledgement of what's going on, yeah. I think, so that the audience isn't sitting out there, or at least particular parts of the audience, you know, appealing to the screen like, "Oh, come on, you know, when are we going to hear something like this?" They've now heard it. I got to agree though that the misogynist lines from M do sort of date the film a little, and I think they're there more for the audience than something the character would perhaps credibly say. Yeah.
And then of course you've then got the antagonists, so add to Sean Bean and or should I say Alec and Xenia, you've got Godfrey John as General Oromov, who's sort of this, I don't know, he's, if anyone's a relic of the Cold War, it's him.
Yes,
I think in this film he really is. He's sort of trying to hold on. I mean, he goes toe to toe against the Russian Defense Minister Mishkin in a couple of scenes in this film, where he's really, you know, he wants to return to the old order. You know, where the Soviets are, or should I say, the Russians, you know, want to return to the Soviet Union. You know, there's more power, obviously, as well, and he sort of aligns himself with Alec and Xenia. And then, of course, to round off the baddies in this film, you've got Alan Cumming as Boris, or should I say, "I am invincible," Boris. I mean, I'm sorry, this is the worst part of casting in the film.
Absolutely terrible. It's a joke. I mean, what is he supposed to be? He's not in any way a threat. He loses it towards the end, doesn't he, when he's saying to her, "Give me the password, or don't ever do whatever she did, don't ever hit me again." But otherwise, there's no sense. And you also don't get any sense of why he's doing it, do you? Why, we know why Alec Trevelyan's turned baddie. Why has he turned baddie? I mean, we're just assuming it's the cash. There's no sense of that. But he's just really, really annoying, irritating, greasy geek type, isn't he? In other words, what you might call a typical podcaster.
And Rob, what did you make of Boris? I mean, I'll tell you what, one thing I couldn't stand is just the way, you know, that first scene when he's calling everybody slugheads. It's just, what?
Yeah.
It's yeah, just, he. What kind of an insult's that?
He's a character I really hated the first time I saw the film in the cinema. I remember that. I've kind of warmed to him over time. By warmed to him, I've just become less hateful towards him, I guess. But we were talking about accents earlier, and Steve was talking about when he gets angry towards the end of the film. His Scottish accent comes through so clearly in some scenes. It's quite funny. But as to his motivation, maybe he just likes hacking. Maybe, you know, I kind of get that sense from him, perhaps. He's doing it just for the thrill. like he hacks into US secret facilities for fun, it seems. But yeah, and he's an odd one, like this Russian in a Hawaiian shirt or whatever it is. I don't get it.
And then rounding off the cast, we've got Robbie Coltrane as Valentin Zukovsky. There's quite a nice bit of sort of background story with Zukovsky and Bond. Bond gave him the limp, as he says, shot him in the leg. And there's quite a nice bit of friction in the scene that they share together. And of course, then, I mean, the staple of James Bond films, Desmond Llewelyn in his 15th appearance as Q, too, in what I think is arguably one of the best Q scenes as well. I mean, what did you think of their casting and, you know, their involvement in the film?
It's not really a casting decision for Desmond Llewelyn, isn't it? It's almost like it's no more a casting decision than the gun barrel sequences or having his boss called M. He is, shall we say, as much a part of the Bond franchise, that actor, as the character of Q is, isn't it? So for instance, when you go and see in the later movies, is this his last appearance to Desmond Llewelyn?
No, he made two further appearances.
But when you see the later movies, John Cleese becomes Q. You think, oh yeah, yes, this is the bit where there's always the bit in the film where he goes and visits Q and everything's blowing up and he gives him all these gadgets. But it's far less of a reminder, oh yes, I'm in Bond world, than it is when he's actually being played by Desmond Llewelyn. I think he's glorious. I think there's a lovely warmth between the two of them, which you don't get with him and Judi Dench. Possibly because she's playing the hard-nosed Queen of Numbers. But I think it really works really well. I'd love that bit where, you know, I don't think the "don't touch that, that's my lunch" thing worked well on first viewing, but yes, it's not funny after that. But just while they're, just before he's about to pick up his baguette, they've got this scene where there's this guy in an ejector seat in the background who flies across it. And I think that's absolutely hilarious, that. But, no attention is drawn to it. It's just something that's happening without question in the background. Like the guy who goes into the BT phone box and no one even mentions it's happening. I think it's lovely.
It's just an everyday occurrence in Q Branch, isn't it? I think, really, that kind of stuff. Isn't it? If you look closely at Desmond Llewelyn in that scene with the BT phone booth in the background, he's reading his lines from a cue card.
Oh, really? Behind, that's interesting.
Yeah, behind Pierce Brosnan. Yeah, you can sort of follow, his eyes are following, sort of going from side to side, and he's not quite looking at 007 in that scene. But Rob, what did you make of Robbie Coltrane in this film?
Hagrid, yes. I like him a lot, and particularly in hindsight, knowing he comes back in later films, you know, and this is going to be a bit of a character, an ongoing character. It's good to see him. I love the bullets he fires at 007's knees and at his nuts. You know, he's not quite the threat of Alec Trevelyan. You know, he's a bit more low market, low rent. He's got Minnie Driver off on stage singing an awful rendition of Stand By Your Man.
Is that Minnie Driver?
Yeah, that's Minnie Driver. Yeah. She's the nightclub singer. And yeah, look, I think it's an interesting character. It's not overdone. He's not in the film for too long, and it sets him up to make some return appearances. So it's a good start.
I mean, let's go back now and just have a look, or let's discuss the plot of the film. How do you think it stands up 20 years later? I mean, is it one of the more engaging Bond films, one of the ones that you know, can sort of throw on a Sunday afternoon, let's say?
For me, it is, absolutely, because I always thought Brosnan would make a good Bond, and unfortunately, out of his four outings, this is my favourite of them all. I think he tended to go downhill from here. So, you know, if I feel like watching Brosnan as Bond, which is a feeling I would definitely have, because I think he is a good Bond, this is the one I would go to because it's the best of his four.
The plot, I think, matters more when they're trying not to do iconic Bond films. When they say, right, we'll take away all these elements of classic Bond and we'll try and play it as if it's almost just another spy thriller. Then the plot becomes more important because you've not got all these pleasers that the audience are waiting for. No one, for instance, no one cares that, if you're talking about what do we think of the acting, no one really cares that Desmond Llewellyn's clearly reading his lines off a cue card, because it's his presence that matters for us. It's old Q again. I think with this, the plot, I mean, are they ever credible? I suppose you've got to tread a line somewhere between, haven't you? Being, the plot being on one side so ridiculous, like, oh, let's poison the world so we can all live in space, that people think, wow, how spectacular an idea. And on the other hand, being so trivial that you think, what, Bond got out of bed for this? And I think it works quite well, that. I think the Zapper thing up at the Golden Eye, I should actually remember its name, it's the name of the film. The Golden Eye in space is a good idea. I suppose Sean Bean's motivation is interesting. Sean Bean, sorry, Alex Trevelyan, it's interesting. It's only watching this last night for this podcast that I'd actually twigged. I hadn't picked up previously that he's descended from these Cossacks. And so that motivation comes out. Because I wasn't quite sure. I was watching this and thinking, does he actually just manage to escape from the explosion at the Russian chemical weapons research thing at the beginning? Or does he escape because actually he was never there in the first place? He was never on Bond's side in the first place. And he was always working with the Russians. And it wasn't until I twigged the thing about the Cossacks that, oh, of course, that's what happened. I mean, in a sense, I did wonder whether they originally it was meant to be that his resentment against Britain, or England as he phrases it, was that he'd been left behind to burn in this chemical fire. And maybe they thought, oh, maybe that's not, enough of a motivation. We must make it to this Cossacks thing, which is really a throwaway line, isn't it, in the film? There's not enough oomph given to that concept of make us think, oh yes, well, we can understand that that Sean Bean might have a point. Alex Trevelyan, sorry. But I don't think you watch Bond films for the plot, really.
Well, let's move away from the plot and let's go to what people do watch the Bond films for, or one of the main reasons why they watch 007 films, and that is the set pieces. Now, you start off with the set piece at the dam, don't you? And it's one of the best, isn't it? It's one of the best cold openings, I think, of a Bond film. But then, of course, we move on from the bungee jump to the skydive after the plane. Now, Rob, what did you make of that sequence? I mean, it's got to be up there, hasn't it, as one of the most exciting moments.
Well, look,
in the film.
Yeah, I mean, it defies the laws of physics, but I remember in the cinema, it's this wonderful moment where he's chasing after the plane on the motorbike, and then the plane goes off the edge of the runway, and you think, oh, well, he's got to pull up and stop and find some other way out of this. But no, he rides right off the runway. And for that moment, you think, well, how's he going to get out of this? And then you sort of see him skydive towards the plane. You can tell what's going to happen. You're thrilled to it happening. And then he pulls up just in time. Fantastic. Again, defies the laws of physics, but great fun.
It would have been awkward, wouldn't it, if he'd managed to pull up just in time and then the motorbike had hit the cockpit.
Yeah, he didn't plan for that eventuality, did he?
I think he's lacking in these money scenes. I think in a lot of the best Bond for me is, I'm a big fan of epic films or movies like the thing they were making in the 50s and 60s, Ben-Hur, Spartacus, El Cid, things like that, where you almost lose track of time. You're not, in the old days, checking your watch, but in these days, checking the little digital timer on the front of your DVD player and thinking, oh, how much long has it got to go? It can last for not many hours or lots of hours, and you're completely taken into the world because you've got this thing where you've got iconic scene after iconic scene. And by iconic scene, I don't mean, oh, huge explosion in an underground volcano. I don't mean jumping off a cliff and jumping off a dam. But scenes where there's something you think, oh, that's so well acted, well written, well designed and shot, that it's a scene that you've let's say you jump off. Let's say you've got GoldenEye. It's not a film I've watched a load of times, but you've got this thing where he manages to get into the plane. The plane pulls up, amazing. But then I'd be thinking, oh Lord, after this, we've got to go to that boring, silly car chase scene where you've got the annoying psychologist girl in the front seat saying, oh, James, don't drive so fast. That's really annoying for me. And it's almost thing where your thumb's twitching for the fast forward button on the remote. Whereas something like, let's say Goldfinger, I can't miss the next scene because it's that. And, oh yes, and then it's that scene after that, and that brilliant scene then. Whereas with GoldenEye, I think you get the amazing jump off the dam scene, which is, I think, to me, it's up there with the parachuting off the cliff on skis of Spy Who Loved Me. But the next big money scene, really, is not until the tank chase through the streets of Moscow. And that's quite a long while to be checking your watch and trying to keep your finger off the fast-forward button. An example of what I mean is, I think the meeting with Q is one of those big iconic scenes. Oh, brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yes, admittedly, there is a lot of explosions and high-tech wizardry going on in the background. But you're thinking, oh, brilliant, I can't miss him doing his trademark meeting with Q and pay attention to number stuff. And I think this is lacking in that. And that's a problem I think you get where we're coming out to plotting. Sorry for going on about this. Is where you try to take, as is, I think they did in the Dalton years, they try to take so much of the iconic stuff out of Bond, the women, the gadgets and all that, that you really do need a really strong plot, strong scripting and strong acting, because you can't then rely on the audience forgiving those sort of things, because they're constantly being pleased by, the old favourites coming back. What do you think about that? I mean, does that make any sense? Am I making sense? Or, I mean, there are films, I talk about epics, there are films like, I mean, I watched Cleopatra last night. No, the other night, actually. And which actually Tessa Llewellyn plays a senator in, which is quite distracting. And that's like that. It's scene after scene after scene. And you're just, maybe that does go on for a bit too long, actually. But Cleopatra, I mean, it's 5 hours, even the shorter ones, isn't it? And you, no, say it's in the extended ones, it's 5 hours. And if there's not that, there's amazing orchestral music going on. And it just wholly keeps you within this world. But there we are.
Well, I mean, we'll move on to the tank scene now. one of the bits that really stuck out for me here was, you've got Bond films nowadays are criticised for their product placement. Well, in this, you've quite literally got James Bond driving a tank through this giant, this big sort of truck full of Perrier water, haven't you? Which I think is just, that's fantastic. But it's one of those scenes that I remember as a kid when this film came out. It was one of those bits that was always played on the news or on entertainment programs. It was the big set piece of the film. And it's very well done. I mean, obviously, Martin Campbell directed this. The action shots are great. I mean, there's a real feeling of intensity, which of course then leads to the train sequence as well, which again, when they're running away from the explosion, it, I think, is a very iconic moment in the Bond franchise.
Do you reckon that the marketing division of Perrier managed to outbid the marketing division of Vegemite?
I think it might have done. Yeah. Might have won the bidding war there. But and then, of course, as the film goes on, I mean, you've got the main sort of the main scene towards the end of the GoldenEye satellite, but there's a moment, about, I'd say probably about 5-10 minutes worth of the film that I think they probably could have done without here, and that is when we move from Russia to Cuba. Now, the scene on the beach, I know there's some character building there, with Natalia saying, what, you're so cold, why do you kill? And Bond says, well, it keeps me alive, and she says, I think it keeps you alone. I mean, that's a great bit of dialogue there. but it doesn't really move the plot along. It's not. I don't really know why it's there. We've already had the dressing down of Bond earlier on from Moneypenny and M. And then I've obviously got the lovemaking scene as well, which, I mean, really you could have done without, because you've already got quite an intense hot scene, quite literally, in the sauna with Xenia early on in the film. So, I mean, do those scenes sort of take you out of the moment for either of you? Rob, what do you think?
Well, I guess they're there. They're just trying to slow things down before the final push to the final action scene. So I guess that's why it's there. In the narrative, it's because the CIA agent has told them they don't have their air clearance to get into the base in the little plane until 6 a.m. the next morning, so they got some time to kill. I agree that if you chopped it out, it would make the movie just move forward a bit quicker, but I guess the decision was a pacing one, to maybe just slow it down for a moment. We've had some action scenes, now let's have a nice moment on the beach. Let's show off the BMW Z3, and then we'll go into the final reel of the film, so to speak.
Now, unfortunately, that's another gripe of the film. No matter how much I love Goldeneye, but that BMW, I mean, you've got Q saying, oh yes, this has got a brand new, you know, rockets, this has got, you know, all the mod cons, and Stinger missiles, that's the word he uses. And it's you don't get to see it in action. He trades it in for a plane. And so I don't see why. I mean, it might just be one of these things that we're saying, that they didn't want to take too many of the vital ingredients of the franchise out of the film, you know, considering it was supposed to be his reboot after 6 years.
And it's a BMW. How much did BMW pay to get that in there? I mean, Q might as well say, here's your latest car. It's a Chevrolet, the latest thing off the production lines in Detroit. Slightly takes away from. It's not quite like saying, it's your Aston Martin. You think, ooh, because isn't he driving Aston Martin at the beginning in the chase down the mountainside? Yeah,
it's the DB5. Mm. Yes, it's the DB5.
Yeah, the vintage stuff doesn't really fall into the product placement category. I think BMW. I think all four Brosnan films, BMW paid a pretty penny to have some sort of vehicle in.
Mm. But I just think you might as well have just had the Citroen from Your Eyes Only in there, because it just doesn't serve a purpose. It's just, it's a bit of a shame that. But then, of course, we then move on to the very end, you know, the final scene where you've got this, the villain's lair, as it were, which for me, it evokes memories of Blofeld's volcano in You Only Live Twice.
Well, I was thinking, flying over the Cuban mountains and looking at that, oh no, I can't see anything. No, I can't see anything in here. Every time they fly over a deep mountain lake, I'm thinking, yeah, that's obviously not water. That's what's the scene in You Only Live Twice where they throw a rock onto the lava and they realize it's just metal. I think it's obviously, it's a lake there. It's obviously got something underneath it. And I quite like how the missile comes out of the link up.
It's just that out of nowhere, yeah. And then obviously leads to Bond crashing, and then we got a brilliant the first of two very brutal fights, I think. I mean, Xenia really goes out on a high. I mean, she's more than a match for Bond. Okay, yes, it's Bond who's just survived quite a traumatic plane crash, but you know, she could end him right there and then. Obviously, you know, ends up getting herself in a tight squeeze, let's say, ends up killing her off. But we then move on to the GoldenEye satellite, and you know, I sort of worry for the health of the admin staff in these villain places. I sometimes feel like they've got, you know, sort of a henchman, sort of like a henchman temping agency.
Yeah.
they have to come from somewhere.
Yeah, because they've got a huge admin staff output in this place. You know, you see a woman walk past with a clipboard at one point. You know, it's just nuts.
Providing henchman solutions since 1962.
And then, of course, you know, you've got the big explosion and the... another thing that just makes me wonder whether... You know, why do they need liquid nitrogen tanks in an office? Does anyone know?
Oh, did you not know that Hester Blumenthal's got his own franchise restaurant in the in the supervillain's base. He needs it for his molecular canteen.
What do you think, Rob?
You got a solution behind that? Possibly cooling for the computer servers, perhaps. I don't know.
Because Windows 95 was renowned for crashing, so I suppose that's probably the... That could be it. Yes, that could be it. And then, of course, we've got the final showdown between Trevelyan and Bond. I mean, like I said, this is a brutal fight, isn't it?
You know the thing where the ladders slide down? I was thinking on that. Oh! You know, you know how you cross your legs if someone gets... in a fight, someone gets hit in the knackers. I was sort of clenching my fingers, going, "Oh, if someone's on that ladder, it suddenly slides down. How come he's not getting his fingers chopped off?" Oh, that was smart. That's really threatening thing in a Bond film. Not, "Oh no, is he going to die?" It's, "Oh, that was smart."
This is a brutal fight, and it's a very personal one too. From the point of view that when Bond, the ladder slides down, he hits the bottom, and he actually pulls one of his arms away because it clearly hurts. And he's hanging there. And Trevelyan calls in a gunship. And you think, oh, the gunship's coming in to blow him away. But then Trevelyan decides to make it very personal. I think the red haze has descended at this point, and he just can't see any sense. And he goes down and confronts Bond himself, which leads to his demise. He didn't have to do that at all. He could have just stayed there and let Bond get shot. So it just goes to show the brutal nature, perhaps not wanting to be one-upped by Bond. He wants to finish Bond off here and now.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And like you said, the red mist descends. And it's the reason why he dies at the end. I mean, I know Bond drops him. It's one of the coldest kills, I think, actually, from Brosnan in particular. You know, just to say, for England, James, no for me. You know, make it this personal for him as well. Dropping him to his death. And of course, it takes another explosion to actually finish off Trevelyan, because he's still alive when he lands at the bottom of the...
To be fair, his back's probably broken.
He's bleeding out, and he probably would be cough up his kidney at any moment. But it's a good demise for what I think a good villain. You know, and also, you know, we mentioned before, you know, Natalia, you know, getting hands-on. She's the one who sort of commandeers the helicopter in the end, and obviously ends up saving Bond, and you know the world is safe yet again. I mean, before we wrap up the film, I mean, there's one thing we haven't spoken about, which I think we do need to talk about, and that is the theme tune.
Yes,
of course, Tina Turner. Now, I mean, I think there was a trope towards the end of the 80s where the film themes, I'm thinking The Living Daylights and License to Kill here in general, actually, you know, and A View to a Kill also, they sound very much of their time. I mean, there's more of a sort of a synthesized feel. But then with this, I mean, it's bang up to date, that boom, 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 boom. You know, it's brass, it's back brassy. I mean, what do you both think of the theme tune?
Well, first of all, Hayden, I'm glad that you didn't sink to some, you know, silly levels of trying to use a pun like calling a Tuna Turner or something. We can't have that sort of thing. it's memorable, but I think I like the chorus more than the lines. The lines are, there are certain parts in the lines where you feel that there are too many words fit on the line, so she's having to squash them together. But the golden I think it's lovely. But I didn't think there was much memorable incidental music in the film, because they usually try to replay in slightly what do they call it when a musician does something, rearranged versions of the theme tune during as incidental music, don't they? But I didn't notice that much this time.
Well, the producers didn't. Well, I mean, Goldeneye was written by Bono and the Edge of U2, and of course this.
Oh dear!
It was indeed, yes. Yeah. And this was the second soundtrack contribution they'd made that year, because they'd also written along, obviously, with their band U2, "Hold Me, Thrill Me, Kiss Me, Kill Me" for the Batman Forever soundtrack. But the producers had originally gone with a song called "The Juvenile" by the Swedish band Ace of Base, and this was dropped actually probably quite thankfully when he listened to the Juvenile. But by then, all the incidental music had been recorded. So there was no... This is actually the only Bond film where you don't hear a sort of a reimagining of the title song somewhere along the film. This is the only one. So it's quite... That's quite interesting. But it's because it was almost a late change. But it's a very good song, I think. And I think it's quite timeless, really. I think moving away from the synths of the 80s helps to give it a bit more longevity.
Yeah, I agree. I think although Bono and The Edge wrote it and can obviously produce records in their own right, I think they got Nellie Hooper, who is a bit of an electronic kind of a producer, to put it together in terms of production. Right. And it comes across really well. And you know, talking of them contributing to movies, they've also written for many, many classic artists. I mean, I remember Roy Orbison's album, Mystery Girl. I think they wrote She's a Mystery to Me, which was one of the singles off that. They went through this phase of enjoying writing, I think, for classic artists. I mean, Johnny Cash, they wrote a song with him on the Zooropa album as well. They have sort of a history in doing that sort of stuff with older artists. I think they like it. So, yeah, a classic song sounds good now. Some of the lyrics are a bit strange, maybe can't be taken literally. I don't think they knew what GoldenEye was or would be when they wrote the lyrics, perhaps. But it does the job.
It's the lyric, isn't it? The "You'll never know how I watched you from the shadows as a child." And you think, well, who is that directed at? Is that directed at Bond? Is it directed at the Bond girl? Is it the audience in general? I mean, it's such a weird,
weird line. I thought that was the audience watching in cinemas down the years.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay.
Interesting.
I don't think that's how you think. I wondered if I didn't actually. It could be anything, I suppose.
Hmm. So, to wrap up on GoldenEye, I mean, how successful do you think a reboot it is for Bond? You know, 6 years had gone. We've got a new Bond in place. We've got casting changes all around. This is all of a sudden the mid-90s. I mean, do you think it stands up to scrutiny in today's, in the eyes of today's filmgoers, or in your eyes, do you think it lasts as a good entry in the Bond canon?
Look, I think in today's film-going public's eyes, it probably doesn't hold up. I think what Daniel Craig does in Bond probably holds up better for a modern audience. But this certainly points back to the past of Bond in many ways, and I think that's very popular with a lot of people. So I think it's still successful in that sense. I think, as I mentioned earlier, the plot, the motivation for Alec Trevelyan isn't that outrageous. It isn't unrealistic. It's a bit of cyber espionage, which is still a hot topic today, so that stands up. So it's an interesting crossroads for me. Something that is a reboot and should be pointing to the future, but does tend to point more to the past, and probably wouldn't hold up with today's audience. So it's a weird one, but I love it, and it's the best of Brosnan's four, so, you know, I can't go past it.
It's not a reboot in the sense of Casino Royale was it? Where they're almost taking you right back to the beginning. It's M isn't rebooted so much as the old M, the Admiral, has clearly retired and been superseded. Bond, the difference, the change in actor for Bond, that obviously we ignore, been knowing since 1960, whenever. It's not, I must confess, it's not one that I go out of my way to watch, GoldenEye. From the point where Roger Moore reached the point where he was it in Octopussy? Where he's getting on a bit. And he's clearly not convincing as a super fit secret agent. Possibly up until the arrival of Daniel Craig, I don't tend to immediately think, that's on TV tonight. I must record that. Or I've got nothing to, there's nothing on TV tonight. I'll get a Bond movie down. I don't think I've got any of those DVDs from that period. So it's not something that runs the flag up my flagpole. and it'd be interesting to wonder why that is, because maybe it's not classic enough. I wonder if it lacks a certain confidence that the older movies had. I don't know what it is.
Interesting.
Because it has brought, I mean, it's got stuff like, it's got M and it's got Q and it's got gadgets and it's got girls and it's got ridiculous supervillain volcano lair. But there's still a way that it's, I have no idea what it is really. Because the acting's fine. But maybe there's a sense of having seen it, having said that, having seen it all before. Which, until you get, yes, with Tomorrow Never Dies, you get, oh, I've never seen them, you know, sinking a warship before to do, you know, to, for to push a media company. But you've seen them over and over again doing, trying to start wars between various countries. That's what it is, isn't it? In fact, maybe that's what the success of Casino Royale came with, because it hadn't been done before. I mean, unless you do count the David Niven movie, which most people say don't count. And therefore, there is something different there. It's not even the, you know, what's he going for at the casino? $100 million. Well, it's not billions and billions, is it? So it's not in the realm of ridiculously over the top, but it's something new. No, good film, GoldenEye, but not one that I go out of my way to take down off the DVD shelf. Although I would happily take it down. I would happily seek it out on YouTube, just the clip of him with Q.
Before we give our scores, there is just one other aspect of GoldenEye that I want to talk about, and that is the extended media that it appeared in. Now, in 1997, Nintendo published a game developed by Rare, which was called GoldenEye 007. Went on to be regarded as one of the greatest video games of all time. It was quite a bold step, wasn't it, Rob? To bring it out, you know, 2 years later, because, I mean, this came out August 1997, which is around the time that Tomorrow Never Dies was released in theatres. But what kind of an impact did that game have on the gaming society in general? And also, do you think it added to the mythos of the film?
It's an interesting question. It was certainly weird having a film tie-in game come out 2 years after the film itself. But I think what excused it was that it was so good. For the people at home, it was a first-person shooter, so you're sort of running around. You are James Bond. You're doing little missions. You're obviously shooting people. And look, graphically and sound-wise for the time, it was really, really good. I didn't actually own a Nintendo system myself. I was more on the PlayStation side of things and a PC gamer. But I did have friends who had it. I would play it at their place, and it was fantastic. So it certainly, look, I think it just, rather than introducing Bond to people, I think it just let every boy out there who played it pretend they were Bond, which is what we all want to do, isn't it, really?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this was one of the, like yourself, I didn't own an N64. We were a Super Nintendo family. And then when the PlayStation came out, we sort of hitched across to that platform. But I did have I did have friends like yourself who owned a Nintendo 64, and they played GoldenEye all the time. We used to spend hours up in the bedroom playing on GoldenEye, playing in, you know, the split screen multiplayer mode, which was excellent because it sort of added to the story and the missions, because you could play as you know, sort of characters and villains who, you know, from ages ago, from films stretching back as far as Goldfinger. You had Oddjob in there, you had Hugo Drax from Moonraker, you had Jaws, obviously, from Spy, Love Me and Moonraker, and it was, you know, just a fantastic way, and I think it did add to the mythos of the original film, because it identified so well with the film, because you had, I mean, some of the sort of landscapes that you spawned in. I mean, you know, the bunker, the tank sequence, and obviously the GoldenEye satellite at the end. When I watch the film now, it takes me back to not previous viewings of the film, but it takes me back to playing that game and playing those levels. You know, it's quite remarkable, really.
Yeah, my wife has actually said similar. In fact, as recently as last night when we rewatched the film, she said, oh, this is like playing the game. So, yeah, I know where you're coming from.
Fantastic. And Steve, did you ever play Golden?
No, I'm just aware of it. I've only just known now that you've told me that. I'm just looking at it now, a clip of the game on YouTube. It's quite... So you wouldn't have found me in the 90s spending hours in my bedroom playing with a Golden Eye. But it seems to be a cross between Doom and something like Metal Gear Solid.
Yes, yeah. Of course, it was influenced by Doom, and Metal Gear Solid was influenced by this. I mean, its spiritual successor, you could say, was something like Perfect Dark, which actually pretty much ripped off GoldenEye. I think
it's a PlayStation from my memory. I think that's the first time I ever did any video gaming.
But they've tried bringing it out again and again on different platforms. No, GoldenEye 007 Reloaded was released for the Xbox 360 about 4 or 5 years ago. And of course, they've never really achieved the same success as this game. Why do you think that is? I mean, do you think it's because it was from such a strong film? Or do you think it was because it was such a trailblazer in the world of gaming?
Oh, look, lightning rarely strikes twice in a lot of mediums. But particularly in gaming, I think it was just a really well put together FPS at the right time, graphically, sound wise, as I mentioned earlier. And now it's been done so many times, FPS games are a commodity. You can bring out a really good one, but it's still not leaps and bounds ahead of many others already out there because so many have been made at this point in time. It's just a harder market to cut through, I think, really.
Excellent. Oh, it brings back memories. Makes me wish that I had an N64 now. So I could play on it again. Oh, right, so that's GoldenEye for you, ladies and gentlemen. And only remains for us to give our marks out of 10. So, Steve, we'll start with you.
6, but then I have very high standards when it comes to Bond.
Oh, 6. Oh, Rob, have you been a little bit more giving?
I think so. My first Bond at the cinema, the best Brosnan film, 8.5.
Hey, that's more like it. I'm going to give this a 9. GoldenEye. It's the reason being is because it's the first Bond film that I remember, and it is tied in, you know, with nostalgia as well. I mean, I didn't see it at the cinema, but I remember when it was first premiered on British television, and you know, staying up late and watching it for the first time, and you know, all the time media around then, you know, buying magazines, you know, Pierce Brosnan on the front with his Wolf of PPK, and that, you know, that imagery. The film itself, I think, now 20 years on, does still stand up. I think it's one of the more interesting and believable Bond films, and it doesn't lose its fantastical elements as well. I mean, at the end of the day, we want Bond films to take us out of reality. Mm. You know, that's why they're set in exotic locations. That's why, you know, it's James Bond is a fantasy. It was a fantasy of Ian Fleming when he wrote the novels as well. So this was something that I think GoldenEye does still represent very highly. So for that, I give it a 9 out of 10. Not quite perfect James Bond, but it's definitely in my top 5. Okay, and that leads us on to our next topic, and it's at the minute got a working title of M's Office, because I haven't thought of anything better yet. So this is basically where I'll read out the feedback from the listeners. Of course, we haven't got any listeners yet because this is
the
first
episode. How about Moneypenny's inbox? Moneypenny's in tray.
I might have to give this an R rating if we give it that one, Steve. But there you go. Okay, so the first bit of listeners' feedback is from Jim Cameron. And he says, a great semi-reboot. Exciting and engaging once it gets going, but the baddie Bond girl is way more fun than the goodie.
Yep.
And Brosnan's hair is way too long. Sounds trivial, but this stuff matters.
That's a good point, actually.
And that's followed up with Lee Rawlings, who says, not a bad tune from Tina Turner.
There's always one, isn't there? Lee, how disappointing.
It is a Bond by Numbers song, but still feels big enough. Can't stand you two normally, but the tune works for the time. The film is a good intro to Pierce, but it is odd how it feels quite dated, whereas at the time it felt fresh and modern. Well, that's interesting.
That's not the first time on the podcast I had a letter saying, can't stand you two normally.
I wonder. Yeah, I felt that and all. I wonder if we will feel the same about Casino Royale in 15 years' time. Great moments from Sean Bean and over-the-top performance from Hagrid. And John Galantini has said, in the 6 years 007 was absent from the big screen, the world went through some big changes. The Soviet Union collapsing, millions of people now owned personal computers, and many of them were discovering the internet. All of these events play a huge role in the quasi-reboot James Bond for the 1990s. With its industrial, techno-inspired soundtrack and sleek cinematography, it's Brosnan's best and certainly within the top, and certainly within the overall top 10. Mark Cochran. Bond's dive over the side of the dam still stands up as one of the most memorable cold opens of the series to date. GoldenEye also spawned what has been regarded by many as one of the greatest video game adaptations of all time. Which, yes, I mean, we've just been saying that's brilliant. Thank you very much, Mark. And Paul Taylor Greaves has said, I was there on opening night. Oh, wow. And the buzz in the audience was tremendous. The collective gasp of the opening bungee dive was only beaten by the, not kidding, standing ovation and cheering when Bond dives after the plane in the opening sequence and rescues it from crashing. The rest of the film was a cakewalk. The audience loved it, and despite the frankly hypocritical and grossly unfair bashing Brosnan gets now, he owned that film, and the audience loved it. Still stands up today. A great Bond movie. And finally, James Brigginshaw said, it represents the high point of Brosnan's Bond and also his career. However, due to its nigh-on mythical status, I will always love the video game more. I also think without the game, the film wouldn't be remembered so fondly. Very interesting. Thank you very much for your feedback there,
guys. I say,
guys.
Hayden, if people want to send feedback to the podcast, where should they send it to?
They should send it to podcastersroyale@gmail.com, and there'll be other links also at the end of this podcast. So, now then, while Steve had the honour of drawing the first topic, or the first retrospective for this series, I'm going to leave it upon yourself, Rob, to just walk over with me here in the corner of the room.
Okay.
We've got, you'll be able to see, a roulette wheel.
Oh,
now,
fair enough.
Instead of numbers on that roulette wheel, we have actually got the titles of the James Bond films that we're going to cover. So there's 24 Eon production titles there. And also, just as a bit of an Easter egg, and probably a massive ball ache when we finally get to it, the 1967 Casino Royale, and also Never Say Never Again.
Ooh, okay.
So, if I give you this ball here, then if you could give it a quick spin.
Yes, here we go. Off we go.
There we are.
Okay, slowing. Slowing. And stopped.
Hey! Oh, look at that! Would you Adam and Eve it? So continuing the gold theme, the next episode will be all about The Man with the Golden Gun.
Oh! Hey, that's a coincidence, isn't it? Stopped there the first time.
Thanks for that, Steve. So, that all that remains for me to say is, where can the listeners find you both out there in the big world wide web?
Well, Hayden and I can be discovered fortnightly discussing seminal Doctor Who matters on the Diddly Dum podcast at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com.
I also have a Doctor Who podcast, and you can find it at thedwshow.net. You can listen to the episodes on the website there, or find us on iTunes.
Fantastic. And thank you very much to Rob Irwin and Steve Hayward for joining me on this inaugural episode. Podcasters Royale will return in The Man with the Golden Gun.
You have been listening to Podcasters Royale, a 007 show. Find us on iTunes, Stitcher, at our Facebook page, on Twitter at PodRoyale007, or send us an email at PodcastersRoyale@gmail.com. Podcasters Royale, you expect us to talk?